The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England.
World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Word of Mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Griffith Park in Los Angeles contains some of the most well-known sites in the city, the Hollywood sign, the observatory, the LA Zoo. It is also home to some of the city's most elusive celebrities, mountain lions. Los Angeles is one of only two megacities in the world where big cats live. Urban sprawl also collides with nature in Mumbai, where leopards occasionally kill people who encroach on their territory. As Angelenos continue to spread into the Santa Monica Mountains, these apex predators have become celebrities to some residents. Others consider mountain lions as dangerous menaces, which should be wiped out. Dana Goodyear is author of Anything That Moves and staff writer for The New Yorker, which is where we found her article, Lions of Los Angeles. And Dana, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks so much for having me on.
So give us a sense of that landscape and how many mountain lions live there in this Santa Monica mountain range.
The Santa Monica mountain range is basically, when you're in Los Angeles and you look north, those are the mountains that you see. And they are very densely populated from a mountain lion's perspective. And to people, they can seem very wild still. I mean, there are amazing hiking trails. It can be quite lush now that it has started raining out here again. There are views of the Pacific, and it's a 240-square-mile range. It's also incredibly densely populated in areas. It's where you have the neighborhoods of Bel Air and Brentwood and the Hollywood Hills, and farther east you get to Griffith Park. The other feature of the landscape is that it is crisscrossed with enormous freeways, 8 to 10 lane freeways. So there is amazing habitat there for all kinds of animals, but there are huge obstacles to the movement of those animals, and they're mortal dangers to those animals also. So that size of range, 240 square miles, is about right for one or two dominant males, several females that they would breed with, and then a smattering of the kittens and the adolescent mountain lions that result from those pairings. So what has been happening there is, on the one hand, it's amazing that there is a population of mountain lions in a city like Los Angeles, which is synonymous with sprawl and dense population and pollution and freeway life. And on the other hand, this population is really under threat because these barriers to movement that the freeways represent make it very hard for there to be gene flow with other populations of lions in wilder areas of the state, like the Los Padres National Forest, which is north of that range. And we're seeing a lot of inbreeding in this mountain lion population in Los Angeles.
Well, you write about two individual male lions being tracked by the National Park Service called P45 and P22. First, what do those numbers mean?
So P stands for Puma concolor, which is the scientific name for what we call mountain lion. They have lots of common names, mountain lions, but Puma concolor. And then the number represents the kind of order in which the National Park Service collared and started tracking the animals. So there are also a lot of lions that are not being tracked by the National Park Service, but they have now 10 lions that they're tracking. The reason the numbers are as high as 45, but they go higher than that as well, is that the Park Service has been conducting this study since 2002, so it's one of the longest running mountain lion surveys anywhere, but certainly in an urban area, and some of those animals have died. How they die is also of great interest to the scientists. A lot of them are killed trying to cross freeways. Some of them are killed from anticoagulant intoxication, which basically means that they ate something that ate something that ate rat poison, which is a bioaccumulant, so it gets more powerful as it goes up the food chain, and it just essentially causes internal bleeding, or if they get an injury, they can't stop bleeding. That's how the rat poison works. And actually, the most common way that lions die in the Santa Monica Mountains is fighting with other lions. So lions are naturally quite territorial, but some of the constraints to movement that this population is dealing with causes increased territorialism. So the fights are worse. You know, there's less
because
land.
There's less land for them to hold on to. So, but how about these two individuals, P22 and 45? Why so important to this population? And you focused on them in your article.
Well, these two are interesting for different reasons. P22 became a celebrity, if you will, because he did something that is extraordinary, and his journey that he made from the main part of the Santa Monica Mountains, crossing over then the 405 and the 101 to end up in Griffith Park, it demonstrates how desperate these animals, the adolescents, are to strike out and find new territory. That is natural behavior for a mountain lion to, it's called dispersal. They disperse from their mother. They don't hang out in a family. The mothers and fathers have sort of a transactional relationship for a few days. And then the females raise the kittens and nurse them and then teach them how to hunt. And then when they're about a year and a half old, those kittens, which can be, you know, 110 pounds at that point, disperse. They go off to find their own hunting grounds. And it's incredibly difficult to do when you're hemmed in by these huge freeways. So P22 took an unknown path. People have speculated about what that path might have been. I've hiked parts of what that path might have been. Not easy because of the cars. And managed to get into Griffith Park. Griffith Park is huge to people. It's much bigger than Central Park. It's 8 square miles. But it is very small home range for a mountain lion. It's at 8 square miles when you should be in 240 or 250 square miles. That's the smallest recorded home range for an adult male mountain lion. And what's interesting is that he stayed in there for 5 years. He's been in there at least 5 years, and he has no mate. So he has plenty of deer to eat, and he has no competition. He even actually is presumed to be the culprit of a koala death from the LA Zoo. It's not really clear how he got in there, but he seems to be the one who ate an endangered koala. So he's got a lot of food, but he doesn't have a mate. And I think he's just become symbolic of the difficult situation that these animals are in. He's also interesting because he has revealed the extent of Angelino's tolerance for an apex predator like this. That park is used by millions of people a year for hiking. People bring their families there. There's the observatory, as you mentioned, the zoo. There are a lot of neighborhoods right around there, so a lot of people live very close up against the park. And people generally seem quite happy that P22 is in the park.
My guest is Dana Goodyear. She's a staff writer for The New Yorker, which is where we found her article, Lions of Los Angeles. It's not the name of a gang, but mountain lions living in the Hollywood Hills. Now, Dana, I understand there's even a Facebook page and Tinder page for P22. He is a single male, after all.
Yes, he has far more social media accounts than I do, and he's beloved, and he's become an icon of the park, and I think that that really signifies a shift in people's idea of what the proper relationship is to wildlife. I think, you know, certainly here in the West, the attitude for a long time was that these animals needed to be eliminated to make the area safe for humans, and even Griffith J. Griffith, the eccentric philanthropist who gave the city the park, in the 1800s, he used to hunt mountain lions in there, mountain lions that had gotten into farms and things like that and eaten pigs. So that's the story with P22, and he has engendered a lot of love from the people of Los Angeles. And I think he is encouraging people to think of Los Angeles as a forward-thinking city when it comes to wildlife.
Well, and then you have P45, collared in 2015. Since then, has killed several, quote-unquote, hobby animals. 60 goats, sheep, llamas, alpacas, a miniature horse, a heifer. I mean, these are offenses that would get a lot of predators killed in many places. So why P45 and why P22 not hunted?
Well, P45 has been hunted. So P45's situation is really different. He occupies a large swath of territory in western Malibu. He is definitely the big cat in that area, and he is physically big. He's 150 pounds. He has discovered that there are a lot of animals. You mentioned alpacas, pygmy goats, llamas, a miniature horse. There are a lot of animals in that part of the Santa Monica Mountains. It's a fairly rural community. not all of those animals are well protected or adequately protected against predators. And he found that out. And so he has gone feasting. And I think one of the things that's actually making people really angry at him, and maybe unfairly so, because it is instinct for a predatory animal to continue to kill, but he kills a lot of animals and doesn't eat them. So that enrages people. And I think that the attitude there in Western Malibu is much more of an old West frontier type of attitude, which is, you know, it's man against beast and we have to get rid of this animal, not because we hate mountain lions, but because he is threatening, he's killing our members of our household, because these animals are essentially pets. And I think some people are afraid. There are some older people who like to go walking and people who have young children there. And that's a situation that we can sympathize with, too. But why P45 is very important scientifically is that he managed to come into the Santa Monica mountain range from outside. So genetically, he's hugely important to the population. And passing on those genes that come from north of the 101 is a significant hedge against this kind of downward spiral that can happen genetically. So he has fathered one known litter of kittens with P19, who's a local cat, and together they had P46 and P47. So P19, before she got together with P45, had mated with her father twice, and her father had then mated with one of their daughters. So she represents the kind of crisis of inbreeding. And for her to be able to breed with a male from outside the population and get that, you know, the hybrid vigor is really important. And she has two incredibly healthy kittens who are, one of them was, I got to be part of the capture of, and he's a 110-pound male ready to disperse, and what becomes of him will be very interesting. But when I say that P45 was hunted, what I mean is that it is legal in California to get what's called a depredation permit. So it's illegal to hunt mountain lions under any other circumstances, but if a mountain lion has threatened you or your property, you can seek a depredation permit from the California Department of Fish and Wildlife. And if they grant it, then you may, I think you have 10 days to act on it, you can shoot that animal if it comes on your property again. So this fall, after P45 went on a rampage and killed a lot of animals at a particular farm that had been hit multiple times over the summer, also presumably by P45, the owner of the property was given this depredation permit, and she asked a neighbor to execute it. And that caused an enormous outroar, because these lions, due to the study and all of the education that's been done about this population, have become these beloved figures in the landscape. And so there was a lot of outrage about the idea that P45 would be killed, and perhaps rightly so, because these animals that he attacked were not well protected. So there was a huge debate, and it was quite rancorous about whether or not anyone had a right to shoot this animal for behaving like an animal. In the end, the ranch owner decided not to act on the permit. She called it off.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. And if you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Dana Goodyear. She's a staff writer for The New Yorker, and she wrote about the Lions of L.A. Los Angeles is one of only two megacities in the world where big cats and humans coexist. Before the break, we heard about some individual big cats living in the Hollywood Hills who are being tracked and becoming celebrities in their own right, including P22. P22 even has his own Tinder account. These are predators by nature. So, Dana, I have to ask, have any people been attacked or hurt?
No. This population has never attacked a human, as far as anyone knows. So there have been mountain lion attacks in other parts of the state. They're extremely, extremely rare, but they have happened. I think that the number of fatalities is something like, in California, something like 3 between the years of 1986 and 2014. So going out hiking is not a great risk. I mean, nobody should be concerned about doing that. But something, you know, I've even heard biologists speculate that this population is somehow uniquely adapted to live with humans. They see human beings every day. They cannot avoid us. They would really love to avoid us. they're scared of us, really. I mean, we're not a natural food source for them. And the other thing that's been documented in the course of this National Park Service study is that they have an abundant natural source of food, which is mule deer. The biologists hike in on the mountain lion's kills, the ones that they're tracking, and they have hiked in on 660-some kills, and 86% of those kills are mule deer. That's pretty much what they eat. They also eat some coyotes. You know, have they eaten pets? Well, we know about P45's pet eating, and there are a couple of other lions that have done some of that too. But there's not a lot of evidence of them eating, people's dogs and cats. It's more like these farm animals. And there have been no recorded attacks on humans.
Though they can see us, and they probably do encounter humans every day, they are extremely elusive, and it's pretty rare to get a glimpse of them, although I guess a lot of people are putting cameras in their backyards so they might catch a glimpse. But you did accompany a National Park Service employee, Jeff Sikich, when he was tracking a female mountain lion and her cubs. Did you see anything?
I did, and I felt extremely lucky because I had been told time and time again not to expect to see mountain lions. But toward the end of my reporting, I got a call from Jeff Sikich, and he said, you know, the lions that we had been tracking in the day, just listening for their signals, basically, he said that there would be a chance to catch them that night. So I went out to meet him, and we waited by the Pacific Coast Highway where there was a cell phone signal because the trap connected to his cell phone, but there was no cell phone service up in the mountains. His phone signaled, and we drove up into the mountains, and it was very, very dark and very starry, and it was lush and green, and it was the landscape was illuminated by the headlamps that the biologists were wearing, and we sort of scampered up a little hill and into the into National Park Service land, and there were these two incredible animals in traps. They had, so P19 was traveling with her two kittens. They didn't expect that all three of them would go into the traps, and they only had at that point enough roadkill deer to use as bait to bait two traps. So P19, the mother, and P47, the male kitten, went into the traps. And the entire time that the biologists were working up these animals, they sedate them, and then they measure them and weigh them and look at their teeth and take their blood and assess their health. In general, that whole time, P46, the female, was in the bushes right behind us. And what was amazing about it was that she was chirping, calling to her mother and brother.
Aww.
And then you just don't, it sounded like birdsong and not at all what you expect to come from this magnificent beast. And then once her brother was given a reversal shot so that he would wake up again, he and she began chirping back and forth to each other, and you could only imagine what they were saying.
Oh,
you know,
my goodness.
I thought it was really moving. It was so incredible. And I did get to put on gloves and handle P19 when she was sedated, and what shall I say? I mean, it was a really stirring experience to be in the presence of an animal like that. And then once the animals were woken back up, it was a terrifying experience because, you know, we were so close to them, and they were pretty feisty. At least, actually, P19 wasn't, but P47 was. The kitten was feisty, and the biologists were so calm, and they said, he's just going to run off into the bushes, and eventually he did, but he didn't leave until he had snarled and rattled around a bit and bared his teeth and hissed and done all of these kind of threatening things. But I think he was, you know, obviously just protecting himself. And then he dashed off into the bushes, presumably to join his sister.
Well, so much going on there. First, we should mention that when you say trapped the animals, there was no harm done to the animals. But also this kind of idea that you were holding something wild that has become a kind of, you know, celebrated cause there in the Hollywood Hills by some people, but still a wild animal and a dangerous animal. And you know, this comes across as sort of emblematic of a little bit of a culture clash between the urbanites spreading out from the city and then those who live there who have traditionally seen mountain lions and other predators as threats, as enemies. Yeah. I mean,
it's really interesting. And what will happen, you know, if P-22, the one who lives in Griffith Park, hurts or scares someone, he will be killed. There's still a line there. And I think attitudes could really turn on that. But he's had a lot of opportunities to do that already and has not even chosen to be visible to people there. I mean, people do not spot him in Griffith Park. He goes out at night, and you have to work really hard to even capture him with the camera. The great big cat photographer, Steve Winter, who works for National Geographic, spent over a year getting a shot of P-22.
Well, just one shot.
The shot he wanted. He wanted P-22 in front of the Hollywood sign, and everything lit perfectly, and he got it, but it took a long time. So chances are it's not going to happen, but all I'm saying is if it does, I think attitudes will reverse pretty quickly. The other reason that these animals are important and why the National Park Service, but also the National Wildlife Federation, are doing a lot to publicize their stories is that they really need a solution to the impediments to their movements that are there in the form of these freeways. So there's a big campaign underway to build a land bridge over a section of the 101 freeway that will allow these animals to leave safely and come back in safely, and their behavior should be positively affected by that. You know, their increased territorialism and the fighting, and that is due to space constraints, or that's what's presumed by the biologists. So they're trying to raise $50 million in private money to build this beautiful, in the renderings, land bridge that would basically would kind of funnel the animals uphill, and it'll all be planted with native plants. Humans will be able to walk it too, but over 8 to 10 lanes of the 101 freeway and deposit them on the other side. So that's kind of the hope for this population. And I think for now they represent the triumph of nature over culture in a way that, you know, we've done a lot to modify this landscape. And I think human beings now, and this at least people in Los Angeles, are starting to question some of the major interventions and wonder if there's a way we can go back and find something that's a little bit in between. Because one thing I realized, I've been in LA for 10 years now, or 12 years actually, I hadn't realized myself until thinking about the situation these lions are in, quite how unfriendly to human life the city can be. And even just trying to walk in the places that P-22 probably had to walk to pass into the park, you realize, you know, it's dangerous, and maybe this isn't ideal. And what are the ways in which the lions can kind of lead the way for us to a more livable city?
Dana Goodyear, she is author of Anything That Moves and staff writer for The New Yorker. Dana, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
She was talking with us about her article, Lions of Los Angeles, and there's a link to read it at our website. That's at wordofmouthradio.org.
It's not something that you just dump something on. It's a series of tubes.
It is time for a series of tubes. It's our regular run-through of the latest tech stories with Rob Fleischman, our tech pundit and principal architect at Akamai Technologies. Hello, Rob.
Virginia, great to be here as always.
Well, great to have you with us. First story today, though, we've got the Winklevoss twins, those strapping, crew-rowing lads of Facebook and the social network fame. Now they got a bit of bad news, something to do with Bitcoin, which I know you've explained to me before, but just a little primer again?
Absolutely. So we talked about Bitcoin back in 2014. And if you remember, Bitcoin is a cryptocurrency and peer-to-peer exchange. And what that means in English is it's a way to pay for things in a currency other than dollars. And I'll encourage anyone to go back and listen to our segment. We had a really great time back then in 2014. And the Winklevoss twins were active back then. They were great buyers of Bitcoin. So getting back to our story, you know, what happened? The Winklevoss twins proposed a Bitcoin ETF to the SEC, to the Security Exchange Commission.
ETF, Exchange Traded Fund.
Exactly, right. And the Security Exchange Commission turned them down. So what does all that mean? What it means is the Winklevoss twins were really looking to create an ETF, which is a financial instrument, much like a mutual fund, ETFs usually track indexes. For example, there's an ETF called SPY, which tracks the S&P 500. And there's one that called QQQQ, which tracks the NASDAQ. So these are financial instruments that you can buy. You know, you can go down to your local broker, your Fidelity, your E-Trade, what have you, and you can invest your money in these things. So what the Winklevoss twins were trying to do was to create an ETF, a financial fund, that normal people could buy. And that fund, instead of tracking the S&P 500 or the NASDAQ or any other index, would track the value of Bitcoin.
Uh-huh.
So what they were really trying to do, in my eyes, I think their strategy was to make the ability to invest, to buy and sell Bitcoin much, much easier. Basically available to the masses, to the tens of millions of people that invest every day. If you listen to our old segment, I went into detail about how you do Bitcoin today. It involves a Bitcoin wallet and wiring money into an exchange and having it converted into Bitcoin. And you know, it's quite technical even today. And of course, there's a lot of fraud and a lot of...
Right, because it sounds like a load of hooey to a lot of people. There's no real actual money behind it. But Bitcoin does go up and down. What is this rejection by the SEC done to the value of Bitcoin?
Oh, it's fascinating. So Bitcoin's been very volatile. You're right, it's moved a lot. And when the SEC said no to the Winklevoss twins, Bitcoin tumbled over 15%. In one day, moved a tremendous amount after this rejection, which, by the way, goes exactly to what you're saying, right? I mean, there's no one really behind Bitcoin, nobody backing it. I mean, our U.S. dollars, right? They are, quote, backed by the full faith and credit of the United States, and there's no one really standing behind Bitcoin. You know, the SEC's rejection of the Bitcoin ETF, you know, their basis was exactly what we're talking about. They were worried about potential for fraud, and really, you know, the lack of regulation. You know, who's controlling it? What are the rules? So they put a big pause on the ETF. I don't think the Winklevoss twins are done. I think they're still going to keep pushing forward because of this tremendous financial advantage for them being huge holders of Bitcoin, right? Imagine if, I mean, we all remember back from Economics 101, buyers and sellers, supply and demand, right? If you create much more demand by creating an ETF with millions and millions of potential buyers, wow, that's probably going to make the value of Bitcoin go up. So it'd be very advantageous to the Winklevoss twins, who are large holders of Bitcoin.
How about Rob Fleischman? Wasn't he going to invest?
No. We talked about this a long time ago, Virginia. I'm still not a holder of Bitcoin, and I still, personally, my opinion only, I'm not a buyer, and I do not recommend buying Bitcoin as an investment.
All right, next order of business, one of those futuristic technologies quickly becoming a reality. This is the exoskeletons. What are exoskeletons?
Wow, exoskeletons, power suits. I mean, we're talking Iron Man, 1968 comic books. Back then, you know, these guys wrote this comic book about a guy named Iron Man, and we've all seen the movies, which are great, right? The idea that you have some mechanically super-powered suit that you can wear outside of your body, where you're inside of it, maybe like a robot or maybe like some type of skin or armament that you attach to your body that gives you superpowers. Human augmentation and super strength. So, Virginia, one of the great opportunities is for people with disabilities. You can't walk and you put on some legs that are on the outside of your legs and all of a sudden you can stand up. All of a sudden you have mobility out of the wheelchair. Really fascinating stuff, really compelling. And you can look at it as not just for the handicapped, but maybe for the elderly. I mean, we all have seen electric bikes, right? Where they're normal bicycles, but they have a battery that gives you a bit of a boost, right? You can imagine something similar for elderly people as they have trouble getting out of chairs or trouble lifting or moving things. And then, of course, you can take it into the superhuman, where maybe I'm a factory worker or I'm a logger, I'm a guy who works with timber, and I want to move giant logs around. Well, if I have some, you know, super strength on my arms, I might be able to do that. But, you know, there's even more practical uses for police and firefighters or people that work, you know, defusing bombs. It's a really fascinating area, really nascent technology where we're just starting to see some of these exoskeletons.
Okay, so how much do these cost?
Oh, these are tens of thousands of dollars and generally are hobbled by their lack of power, right? I mean, these things, you know, they take a lot of power to move you around and to do some of these superhuman activities. So right now, a lot of them are tethered, right, with wires and power cables. And maybe eventually we'll come up with Tony Stark's power device that we can
strap
on. Right,
he had a power source, if I'm remembering correctly.
Absolutely. That was the key to the Iron Man suit, right? The power source in his chest that had incredible power density and could help him do all sorts of superhuman tricks.
And also the most vulnerable spot.
Exactly.
There
yes,
you go.
You are a comic comic book reader.
Well, you're leading me right into the next thing I wanted to ask about, what could be a really game-changing technology. This is a glass battery, and a glass battery developed by a man named John Goodenough. So, you know, this apparently could seriously outperform batteries we use now. First of all, who is this guy?
So, John Goodenough is a 94-year-old University of Texas professor. Brilliant, brilliant man. One of the co-inventors of the lithium-ion battery that we all use today in a lot of our devices and electric cars and all sorts of places. So, you know, I wanted to step back and just think about batteries for the moment. You know, this is a unique time in our lives where here is this technology, batteries, where any attribute of that technology that gets improved is a multi-billion dollar idea and a huge benefit to humanity. So let's think about that. So you have a battery, we all have them. We can go and pull a D cell out or a AA. So every battery has a certain amount of power density, right? If you improve that, that's an unbelievable thing for us. Discharge rate, the ability of a battery to supply power, if you improve that. If you change the costs of battery, make them much cheaper, make them out of materials that are less expensive.
Right, none of this rare earth metals, that kind
of thing. Get rid of the lithium. What if you can make it out of something that's common? Changing the weight of batteries, right? We have batteries in electric cars. What if you cut the weight of a battery in half? Oh my, how much value that would provide. The materials, making the materials you make it out of earth-friendly, as you talked about, making them disposable, changing the shape of batteries, making it so they're flexible or smaller or thinner, or even something as simple as life cycle, making it so the batteries last longer. So here we are. We have this technology, batteries, where if you can change any attribute of it in a significant way, oh my goodness, what an incredible advancement for humanity. What an incredible multi-billion dollar invention and idea you have.
Freebie tip from Rob Fleischman.
Hey, great career direction. You know, I'm full of envy. I wish I had gone in that direction. I'd be doing great.
It's never too late, Rob.
Maybe you're right. Maybe I could become a chemical engineer.
John Goodenough is 94.
I got plenty of time.
Now, what has he done that has revolutionized
Absolutely. Batteries? So Dr. Goodenough down at UTexas has announced what they call a solid state battery. Okay, so what does that mean, right? So our lithium...
I've been hearing solid state since Realistic from Radio Shack.
Exactly, right? Your solid state AM FM radio, right? That was unbelievable. So it's exactly the same thing. So our batteries today have what they call liquid electrolytes. So this fluid that the battery is made out of, this goo that the electrons flow through and are stored in, right? If you crack a D cell open, it's kind of gooey and gross in there. Please don't do that, by the way.
Don't want to touch it.
Don't do that. It's dangerous stuff. But what he's done is he said, hey, I'm making a solid-state battery, basically made of glass. So it's solid. It's not a liquid. And his invention, he claims that the power density of this battery is 3 to 10 times the power density of existing lithium-ion batteries that are not solid-state. And that's really, as I said before, an incredible discovery. Now, there's a bit of controversy here, Virginia.
Always.
Some researchers have claimed that what Dr. Goodenough claims is impossible, that he's talking perpetual motion machines, that his experiment is flawed, and, you know, so they want to hear more. So I'm optimistic. I think, you know, this man, Dr. Goodenough, has come up with some incredible stuff before. I think he's got a great team down at UTexas. And maybe he has something here, but, you know, it's a wait and see.
Rob Fleischman, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Always wonderful to be here, Virginia. Thank you.
Rob Fleischman, he is our tech pundit and principal architect at Akamai Technologies. Up next, a trip to the market and kitchen with Keith Saracen. Some local food ideas that will get you through the season of dirty slush. It's when word of mouth continues. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott, and I'm in a food rut. I really do love to cook, and I love the idea of eating locally sourced food. But by mud season, my motivation and taste for squash and potatoes grows stale. So I asked Keith Saracen to help jolt me out of my habitual dishes. He's chef and founder of The Farmer's Table. He and his crew do on-site farm-to-table dinners using locally produced foods. To be sure, cooking local is easier in the spring, summer, and fall when local farms are bumping. But considering that we just got a foot of snow last week, what does he cook in the winter?
So, how adventurous do we want to go? We
can go as adventurous as possible.
I met up with Keith at the Winter Farmers Market at the Mark Fisk School in Salem on a chilly Sunday morning. The challenge? Buy local foods and put together a meal so delicious that we, thinking I'd bring back something to share with my colleagues, would forget for a moment the dingy gray piles of slush outside.
What's your strategy, Keith, going into a place like this? Like, what are you looking for?
The first thing I look for is the quality of what we can get for vegetables right now. Mm-hmm. There's still some vegetables from the root houses and stuff like that, so I go vegetable first.
Okay.
That strategy is a kind of full-body experience for Keith, seeing and smelling the produce. And warning, this is an NPR food segment, so you are going to hear some...
Those smell fantastic.
Nice, right?
Oh, I see.
And watermelon
beautiful
rashes.
Beautiful watermelon rashes.
Yeah. Mm.
There's also a lot of touching.
First thing I want to feel for is a firm texture.
This one looks a little wrinkly.
Yeah, you can push on it, and mm-hmm. you see how it kind of springs back a bit.
Firmer. And even listening, which for him means going to the market without an agenda.
We kind of just go and let the ingredient say what it wants to be, which is weird and spiritual, but it makes sense.
Here's the ingredient.
Yeah, I'm the ingredient whisperer.
I gotta say, come end of winter, early spring, vegetables are not really speaking to me. I do buy foreign fruit and meat and fish at the supermarket. And if I'm in town, I do walk to my winter's farmers markets and pick up greens and onions, but mostly clomp past the baskets of turnips and rutabaga and celerac and my heavy boots to grab a loaf of my favorite bread before it sells out. Toast is my true winter staple, which is a little embarrassing to admit to Keith.
Those onions
Have
look
I
fantastic.
Have I ever cooked a rutabaga in my life? No.
Really?
No.
We might just put you in an apron then, and then you can check that off the bucket list.
It's not on my bucket list.
Well.
Or Celerac, for that matter.
That's another one I wonder about, Celerac.
Celerac's awesome.
What do you do with it?
A lot of different things. You can make a slaw out of it, puree.
Celerac, for the record, is the root of the celery plant. It's a tuber, and you can cook it like a potato.
It's one of those things that people go, I don't know what to do with that, and they then avoid it as a result of it.
Keith, I soon see, is more than an ingredient whisperer. He's a local produce booster. He refers to sunchokes as the New England truffle and looks most kindly upon imperfect vegetables. The parsnip with teeny bug trails, or the carrot gnarled by New England's rocky soil.
When you see tomatoes in the summer and stuff like that, a lot of people will go for that perfect tomato. If I'm doing sauces, that's the last thing I want. I want those ugly fruits. The ugly fruits and vegetables have such a purpose, and that's the stuff that when you walk into a grocery store, you don't see that anymore, right? Everything's perfect and pristine. But nature is cruel, and nature has some backbone to it. And so what we want to do is we want to say, okay, what are we doing with the product, and how can we help the farmer? That's where it starts.
We go dish by dish, inspired by what's there. Keith's instinct for rescuing misfit vegetables steers us towards what the farmers can't get rid of.
Question for you.
Yep.
What do you have too much of right now?
Too much?
I know, weird question.
So we buy a lonesome porterhouse steak, and I nearly keel over when I pay $26, and quark. Not the subatomic particle, but an often discarded dairy product.
Quark is kind of like a German cream cheese. Basically, it has the texture of ricotta, and since their cows feed off grass, it has a little bit of grassiness to it, which is beautiful.
Plus pea shoots, carrots, onions, watermelon radish, and celerac.
Okay, so that's relatively little. That's funny. Just a couple carrots and some radish. Okay.
And then Keith brings up something I am always willing to buy.
Coffee.
I could use a coffee.
My response is Pavlovian. Keith envisions using it for flavoring the carrots, a plate of coffee, cream, and sugar. made of vegetables.
Sweetness of the coffee, that acts as your sugar. The earthiness and deepness of the coffee is going to come through in the carrot because it's porous. And then cork for the cream. We got a dish.
We pick up some locally roasted coffee for $11. That's the smallest bag they sell it for. Altogether, we're in for $61, and we decide that next time we'll aim for a much tighter budget.
Want me to hold your coffee for you, dear?
Yes.
I can do it for you.
You are an all-purpose guy.
You know.
The next day, we meet at a friend of Keith's roomy kitchen in Nashua. Pots are simmering on the stove, and he's prepped a neat row of ingredients in small bowls.
Okay, so what have we got here?
Over here, those wonderful watermelon radishes that we got.
Keith builds up a little teepee of coffee-infused carrots above the layer of soft cheese. He adorns it with pickled watermelon radish and cumin-toasted breadcrumbs and one artfully layered pea tendril.
It's good.
It is freaking delicious.
Good.
I don't know if I can say that on the radio.
Altogether, it is yummy and more inventive than I would have thought of, but it is simple. Keith says that's the trick. With food this good, you just have to work not to mess it up.
Okay, loving the first course.
Second course.
The fanciest thing? He's sous-viding the porterhouse steak. That is a thing. Sous vide is French for under vacuum, basically sealing food and seasonings in a vacuum pack and immersing it in a slow, warm, gentle whirlpool bath.
Wow. The pea shoot tendrils are awesome.
And finally, Chef Keith sits down, not to eat, but to talk.
What you have in front of you is 100% local.
I am completely sold on the food and on Keith's devotion, which does not come off as even remotely pious. Keith grew up in Nashua and found his way to loving food by experimenting with his grandmother's cookbooks.
I think I got tired of eating box mac and cheese. God bless her, but she's not the best cook. And so for us, it was a necessity. She would work two jobs. I would come home from school.
20 years later, he's established himself as something of an evangelist for local food, and the relationships and community that it builds.
We want to be able to support local farms, but also introduce people to a new way of eating.
Still, stuck in my Yankee craw is paying $61 to make an everyday, meaning not dinner party, meal. The food is undeniably gorgeous and delicious, but fresh local food is a more expensive choice for many families. What does that mean for someone like Keith? Who's known what it's like to struggle?
There's no question that there's a cost that is much higher associated with buying local. But cost is subjective. Do we value the cost up front of the money that we're spending on local healthy products, keeping our money right here in this community? Because at the end of the day, we're voting with our dollar. When we go to a supermarket and we purchase a tomato, that tomato is typically picked 3,500 miles away by migrant workers. That tomato is picked when it is actually not ripe, ripened with ethylene gas over the course of this trip to that supermarket. When you buy that, you're buying a system. If you buy the tomato from the farmer, you're buying a system. It's all up to what we want to do.
I'm going to eat more.
Please do. You want anything to drink? Water?
Yes, water would be great. No ice. You know what, I just decided I'm not going to share this with my colleagues. I'm going to bring it home and eat dinner tonight.
In my defense, the portions were kind of delicate. You can see photographs of the mud season meal cooked by Keith Saracen, the chef and founder of The Farmer's Dinner. He is an intuitive chef, but he did write down the recipes so you can try them at home. All of that is at wordofmouthradio.org. Thank you for spending some of your weekend with us. Music in this episode came from Blue Dot Sessions, Uncanny Valleys, and Kamiko. There's loads more to explore at wordofmouthradio.org. We're on Facebook at Word of Mouth Radio and on Twitter at Word of Mouth. And you can search for Word of Mouth NHPR in iTunes or Google Play to listen to our podcast on your own sweet time. And if you like the podcast, please rate it on iTunes, which will help other people find it when shared by word of mouth. Until next time, I'm Virginia Prescott, and this is NHPR.
Word of Mouth is produced by Molly Donahue, Logan Shannon,
and Jimmy Gutierrez.
Our senior producer is
Taylor Quimby,
and our executive producer is Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its board of trustees,
or its underwriters. Word of Mouth is a production
of New Hampshire
Public Radio.